Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to Warbirds in Review. I'm Dan Bolin. You know, this is one of our most popular programs every year with Jack Roush and Bud Anderson. And normally we have Jim Hagedorn here, and today he's unavailable. But I do want to recognize Jim because Scott's Warbird Alley is because of Jim Hagedorn. Let's give Jim a big hand. You look at this beautiful plush grass here. You need to go out and buy some Miracle-Gro and support Jim. I have another friend up here today who is John Tennyson. All of you are aviation buffs or you wouldn't be here, amateur historians or whatever, just like I am. But they're on the TV on the military channel right now. They're running a series called Warbirds. What's it called, John? Missions That Changed the War. That's right. Missions That Changed the War. And it's Gunther Rall, and it's Enola Gay, and it's Tex Hill and the Flying Tigers, and it's a wonderful series. Sleeping Dog Productions down in Green Lake, Wisconsin. That's Scott Kyle Guyette right there. And this is John Tennyson right here. John, welcome.
Well, it is a real pleasure to be here, and one of the things I get to do is introduce Jack Roush. And I guess everybody knows who Jack Roush is, but what you may not know is how much he does for aviation, how much he does for warbirds. And there's been times in my life when it was my job to ask Jack for help and support, not just for warbirds, but for aviation, for EAA, and for this place. And all I can tell you is, because he'll never tell you this, he's one of the best friends Oshkosh and the EAA have. Having said that, I also know what Jack has done to preserve and keep flying the airplanes that he has, including Old Crow and others. And I've interviewed Jack enough times and done enough TV with Jack to tell you that the first thing he'll tell you is that he's a custodian. He's not an owner. If you think about it, we can't do monuments in the sky. We can't preserve battlefields in the sky. We can't put up visitor centers and memorials. So these are the monuments, and nobody's doing it except people who have a heart for it, a wallet for it, and a real belief in it. And having said that, my friend Jack Roush.
Thank you, John. I'm going to talk about the airplanes. I've not been in the Air Force myself. I certainly admire all the people that have defended our country, you know, in air combat as well as on the oceans and on the ground as well. But the hardware that I found an interest in, a solid opportunity to preserve, was obviously the World War II aircraft. I think that it was a zenith of technology. There was quantum leaps. We went from having Model A Fords were probably Model A and vintage early 30s cars were half the cars on the highway, and we went from that to having jets, rockets, and of course the atomic bomb and all that atomic energy has meant to us. So there was an explosion of technology in that, and one little piece of it that I've chosen to focus on is the P-51 Mustang. When you think of the P-51 Mustang, they were mostly built in the United States. There was a couple of hundred that were built under license from North American in Australia, but North American had two plants. They had one in Dallas, Texas, which was a secondary plant, and their primary plant was in Inglewood, California. The North American probably wouldn't have been in a position to have been to do the B-25 bomber and the P-51 Mustang if it hadn't been for their early success with a trainer. The English came over, British Purchasing Commission came over in 1938 and bought a large group of AT-6s. I think they called them Harvards when they got them on their own shore. But they were AT-6 variants that there's so many of that still fly in the United States. And that really made North American healthy and got them in a position that when the spring of 1940, the British Purchasing Commission was searching for suppliers outside of England that could build airplanes for them. They went to North American, and they were getting airplanes from Curtiss and from a number of other manufacturers, but they went to North American to see if they would take a Curtiss license to build the P-40. And Dutch Kingelberger and the other guys in his management team at North American had a number of ideas about what they'd like to do if they had an opportunity to build a fighter. They felt that the P-40, in spite of Tex Hills and the guy's success over in the Chinese theater, in spite of their success there, they felt that what the Germans had that they were facing with in Europe in particular, and the best of the Japanese fighters far outpaced the P-40. So they were reluctant to take a license for the P-40, and they negotiated with the British. And what they came up with was the 120 days that it was going to take to refit and get established to build the P-40, but they would allow them 120 days to offer an alternate airplane. And they had something like 2,800 drawings for the first airplane. They produced it in 120 days. There was a slight holdup from the U.S. military establishment that was supposed to provide the engine. They were going to use the same engine as the P-40, the Allison V-12, very similar to the Merlin from a layout point of view. And so anyway, they successfully prepared the airplane in 120 days. Soon after that, they got their hands on the engine. And right away, they flight tested the thing, and it was 35 mile per hour faster than the Spitfire 5, which was the European best fighter at the time, and they had used laminar flow wing that the research activity, the National Aeronautics Commission had been working on. Nobody had used that science yet. It looks very much like if you took a bass fish, a plan view of a bass fish, and saw that it was pretty much even down both sides. The left side and the right side had the same shape. Most wings had a fat top and a flat bottom, but the research had been done said that if you had the wing symmetrical and you put the right angle of attack on it, it would have less drag and have adequate lift. So they took that wing, they took the scoop for the radiator, and they configured it in such a way that as the air was heated by going through the radiator and it was liquid-cooled engine, went through the radiator and the oil cooler, that it heated the air and caused thrust. And I don't know if anybody has proven it recently, but the claim was made that the thrust it made due to the cooling of the liquid that was in the heat exchangers caused an offset to the drag that the thing made from being hanging out on the bottom of the airplane. So they had the scoop. They had the laminar flow wing. They paid a lot of attention to the rivets and to the other things that would make drag on the airplane, and they made it substantially faster than anything else in the world at that time. It was even the case that sometime later, the Germans captured some of the airplanes, and they figured out that they were fast, didn't know why they were fast. They never explored the prospect, according to Gunther Rall, that Bud and I were, and a lot of people in Oshkosh here were friends with until he passed away recently. But the Germans were not able to figure out that the wing was the key to it. There were 17,600 Mustangs, the A's, the A-36, the B's, the C's, the H's, and the K's produced. The first B model with a Packard engine came online in 1942. The advantage the Packard engine had, the Packard-built Rolls-Royce engine had, it was a two-stage, two-speed, mechanically driven supercharger. It would make sea level horsepower over 30,000 feet and had a service ceiling of 42,000 feet at maximum gross weight. So the English looked at the early A models that they bought a number of hundreds of as downstairs maids. They said that they were reign supreme below 13,000 feet, but above that they really couldn't go take the war to the Germans, who had turbochargers and had other means of supercharging that made their airplane superior to what the original A was. The A's had a 4-hour endurance. The A models had a 4-hour endurance, and the Spitfire had only 2 hours, so they had much longer legs. What else have I got on here? The early testing of the B model, the B models were produced in Inglewood, California, and they had the plant that produced the same airplane, like the green airplane behind me here, produced the airplanes they called the C model, and they were the same airplane, and there were about 3,500 short of 4,000 airplanes produced in each factory. There was less than 8,000 B's and C's, which were the airplanes that really Bud went to war with in 1944 to knock the Germans out of the sky before so the bombers could go in and prepare the ground for D-Day. Early B models had a problem with an early B model had a problem with an ammo door coming off. It killed a pilot by the name of Tommy Hitchcock. It attracted a lot of attention. And it went into to a really high-speed dive and had a problem failing the door. They had a problem with the guns jamming. Bud's line crew and his mechanics achieved more than 2 G's of capability in keeping the guns firing, which was a problem. And originally they didn't have an 85-gallon gas tank internal, which gave them another hour and a half when they put that on. The early B models were limited with visibility, where they had a birdcage canopy, very much like the early Spitfires did and the T6 had, where you couldn't really get your head out to see much around the windshield, nor could you get a good view of what was behind you. And the English put a something called a Malcolm hood. When Malcolm was the name of the supplier that was making the same hoods for the Spitfire, same canopies. And the B model that is reminiscent of Bud's third B model in his first tour behind me here was fitted in England with this bubble canopy, which dramatically improved the visibility. Bud will probably comment on that. The biggest problem these early B models had was they looked too much like an ME-109. And if you looked at the white stripes on the wing and on the horizontal, they were sort of identify them as American airplane as friendlies rather than German airplanes. The 8th Air Force was the second fighter group. The 357th fighter group was the second fighter group in the 8th Air Force to get the B model. And the 357th fighter group actually had to trade airplanes with another, had to exchange the airplanes with another group to get out of P-47s, which they originally had. And the P-47s were set up to do bomber escort. They were set up to do bomber escort. The 8th Air Force was charged with bomber escort with the P-47s, and the other fighter group was set up to do ground support with the B-model Mustangs. And, of course, the airplanes were absolutely in the wrong place. But that got straightened out very quickly, and, of course, the P-51s beat the beat up on the Germans and prepared for D-Day, and the rest is history. The airplane that's behind me here is the green airplane, was Colonel Anderson's third. It was his third B model, if I understand correctly, and he never got shot down or never had any damage done to his airplane and combat damage. But on days when he didn't fly because there were so few airplanes over there and there was so many pilots and so it's a big job need to be done, his airplane flew every day. And two pilots got shot down in his first two airplanes. He finished up his first tour and went back to meet with his wife or his girlfriend at the time, Ellie, I think. And they reached an accommodation. And he came back and he decided to volunteer for a second tour, which was strictly a volunteer thing. And they gave him a D model that's reminiscent of the airplane that Jim Hagedorn owns behind me here on my right. And he went through his second tour without sustaining any combat damage. In fact, I'm told that my understanding is he never got a bullet hole in his airplane in his D model for the three tours, for the second tour that he made with it. I'm honored to be in Colonel Anderson's presence. It's a great treat to meet with all the folks at Oshkosh that come to be patriots, have patriotic thoughts about what it took to make our country great and the part that Colonel Anderson and so many of the other veterans played to preserve our freedoms and to build for us the economic powerhouse that we've had in the decades that have followed.